In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. If you delve into the history of spying, you might realise that there's a surprising amount of crossover with the world of show business. Stardom has masked spies and agents for centuries, allowing them to go about their business in plain sight, taking advantage of disguise and utilising the networks and access offered by fame. Historian Christopher Andrew joined us recently to discuss his new book, Stars and Spies. Co-written with Julius Green, it explores the long-running links between the intelligence services and the entertainment industry. Putting the questions to Christopher was our digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
The crossover between show business and espionage might seem to some slightly incongruous, as one lives their lives ostensibly in the shadows and one seeks publicity. But your new book with Julius Green explores this symbiosis that exists. And I wonder if we could start by hearing a little from you on this phenomenon.
Well, absolutely. It's an apparent contradiction, isn't it? Because spies have to live in the shadows and stars aren't stars unless they're in the limelight. But when you look at it more closely, of course, in fact, they require the same kind of skills. If you join MI6, our Foreign Intelligence Service, or MI5, the Security Service today, you can't admit that you've done it. You have to pretend to be something else. So it's unsurprising that if we look back quite some time, we can see stars and spies with the same kind of skills. And sometimes stars make really good spies. And sometimes spies make, after they've finished being spies, really good stars.
Indeed. And your book explores so many individual stories that explore this symbiosis. And I wonder if we could start by talking a little more about the time span that you both cover in the book and where the shape of the book came from.
Right. Well, I mean, the book goes back a little bit to almost the first spies and almost the first stars. And one of the continuities through it is the royal family. I mean, Queen Elizabeth II when she opened the Olympics less than a decade ago, she chose to be accompanied by Britain's most famous spy. And Britain's most famous spy is, of course, not a real individual, but a fictional character, James Bond. Now, if we go back more than 1,000 years, we get to Alfred the Great. Now, Alfred the Great was, so far as we know, the British monarch, English monarch in those days, who was best at being a spy and also best at being an entertainer. So when he wanted to know what the Danes were up to, because they were just in the process of almost conquering him, he dressed up as a minstrel and he went into their court. And of course, they were only too glad to have wandering minstrels go in and amuse them. Never occurred to them that he might be the King of England. So he listened to their plans, and the story goes, and it's a reasonably reliable story, he knew what they were up to next day, and he won the battle, and that's why we nowadays speak English and not Danish.
It's a great story, and it's brilliant to think of a royal in employing that disguise. But what struck me as well, you talked about the royal family, and throughout a lot of these stories, is it fair to say there's a crossover for in many cases, that the people with the power, i.e. the royal family, are the people with the power to be patrons of both theatre and then who can run their own intelligence as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the details are in the book. Begins with Queen Elizabeth I, because it tends to be forgotten that in the 1580s, two things happened to England that nobody had expected for the past 1,000 years. One, we become the world's best at theatre. Marlowe and Shakespeare are among names that come to mind. And secondly, we also become best at intelligence, and not simply spies, but also at code breaking. Actually, our code breaking was better, and I'm not exaggerating, in the 1580s than it was in the year 1900. And what makes the difference is that Queen Elizabeth I is passionately interested in both theatre and intelligence. Far more plays are put on at court, some of them by that fellow Shakespeare, than under any previous and most succeeding British monarchs. But secondly, she sees her intelligence chief, Sir Francis Walsingham, every day. And the very last portrait of her reign, the so-called rainbow portrait, is unlike the portrait of, I think, any other monarch in the history of the world. She is portrayed exactly as she wanted to be, so she still looks about 29. But her cloak has two symbols on it, eyes and ears. What does that mean? It means, don't even think about it, traitors. My boys, and it was not an equal opportunity profession then, can hear everything you say and see everything you do. And Mary, Queen of Scots, failure to realise that meant that you got bumped off.
Right. So it's a court, it's a world in which espionage is becoming increasingly more important. And you mentioned him a few moments ago, Christopher Marlowe. He is one who straddles these two worlds as they're evolving in the 16th century. What can you say about Kit Marlowe's activities?
Well, Marlowe went, sorry to burst, to my college in Cambridge, Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. And we can pinpoint, we think, because no official document survives, although there's plenty of evidence that he was a spy, the very moment that he became a star, in the sense of playwright, the very moment that he became a spy, because one of the records that survives in the college is a so-called buttery book. And what does the buttery book tell you? It tells you how much students were spending on food and drink. And in 1585, the amount that he is spending on food and drink suddenly doubles. And I think that's no doubt the point at which he starts getting paid by Sir Francis Walsingham to go off and doing spying as well. But the other thing, which is only just beginning to come clear, is how much Shakespeare learnt from him when espionage is concerned. There's pretty good evidence, increasingly discussed, that Shakespeare, at the beginning of his career as a playwright, 1592, collaborated with Marlowe, who was just about the same age, but didn't have long to go because he was going to be bumped off a year later. So in the latest New Oxford Shakespeare, edited by very sober and reliable scholars, if you look up Henry IV, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, it says Henry IV, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3 by William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe. Shakespeare is the first great writer in English history who uses the word intelligence to mean secret intelligence. There's a Marlowe link with Shakespeare there, which has been too little noticed until very recently.
Absolutely. And you write about Hamlet as well. Many people will be familiar, I'm sure, with this world of spies and intrigue that Shakespeare presents in that play.
Well, of course, what is very ironic is that the very moment when Hamlet is produced for the first time, we do actually have a spy, John Dowland, at the court of Christian IV, the king of Denmark. He was the favourite lutenist, lute player, at the court of Christian IV. And so just like King Alfred at the court of the Danes 600 years earlier, he's able to wander in and out and is extremely useful. But Hamlet, yes, the whole thing is organized really around espionage. Everybody is spying on everybody else. And then there's the play within the play when, you know, there's the reenactment of the killing of King Hamlet. And that it itself, it's often forgotten, inspires the most successful detective story writer of the 20th century, Agatha Christie. And the play with in the play gives the title to the play, which is still being performed in the West End, even as we speak.
And that's a great example of the symbiosis. And is it fair to say that during the reign of Elizabeth I, so much of this intelligence focuses on unearthing so-called Popish plots? And if I can move us forward slightly in the timeline, there is also a key Popish plot then at the beginning of the 17th century, which it goes unnoticed. What's at play there?
Well, the Popish plots, of course, the key one, as it would have seemed to the Jacobeans, is actually Guy Fawkes Day, the Gunpowder Plot. The Gunpowder Plot, which after all comes extremely close to success, is a good example of the difference that it makes if you have an efficient or an inefficient intelligence service. So, you know, the one can see how after the death of Queen Elizabeth I, standards slipped. I mean, they'd been interviewing this man who had, of course, hidden all the explosive beneath the House of Lords, more than enough to blow up the House of Lords and just about everybody in it. And he gave his name as Johnson. And they began to wonder if that was his real name. But they had been interrogating him, and I'm not making this up, for 3 days before the interrogators thought to look inside his pocket. And then they found the correspondence addressed to Guido, Guy Fawkes. So the difference between Elizabeth I, who was really, really good at intelligence, and James I, who was really, really bad at intelligence, makes a huge difference.
Right. So if standards have slipped then since Elizabeth I, who was obviously a key player, a key figure in the evolution of espionage and a woman, I'd like to turn to another woman in your account, Aphra Behn, who, again, she's skipping us forward a bit in the timeline, but I'd love to talk about her activities because it feels like such a perfect example of these two worlds meshing.
Aphra Behn is, as we both know, just extraordinary. But it's worth remembering that for three centuries, she was a forgotten individual. So she was famous in her own lifetime, the Restoration, the 1660s and 1670s. But she was regarded as too rude to have her plays appeared on stage. So virtually no mention of her, except a few expurgated items in the 18th century, and no mention of her in the 19th century. And it's actually not until the 1960s that she starts becoming famous again. So this woman, who was an unperson in the history of British literature and British drama in the 18th and 19th century, is now taught at every self-respecting English course in every self-respecting British university. But it's an extraordinary story because she, unlike Marlowe, becomes a spy before she becomes a world-famous writer. And we can now tell that during her year as a spy, she was actually making up all the reports. What that gave her the example to do was extraordinary creative writing. And then she turns the skills that she had used as a completely bogus spy into becoming Britain's first woman to make a successful career as a writer. And apart from the poet laureate Dryden, she has more plays performed at court, the court of Charles II, that is to say, than any other British writer.
And not to reduce in any way her writing abilities and her accomplishments. She's also, it's planned to use her as a honey trap. And I wonder if we could talk about this idea of female spies being employed as honey traps, what that term means and how it might have impacted this history.
Well, you can, one of the ways that it's possible to suborn other people is by paying them. Actually, there's the FBI has a helpful little acronym, which is the four different ways that you can recruit people to spy for you. MICE. M is for money. You pay them to spy to you if they're working for somebody else. I, ideology. The KGB recruits some, and only a minority of British communists to spy for them because they have ideological sympathies. C is for compromise. Well, how do you compromise people? Well, you can compromise people in all kinds of ways, but if you compromise them financially, it can take years. If you compromise them sexually, it can take about half an hour. And so that is the easy way to do it. Ego at the end, of course, also helps. If the seductor or seductress tells the person who is being compromised that they're extremely attractive, that appeals to their ego as well. So it's pretty difficult to believe, given the period of time, when women weren't recruited if there was a man available. But of course, seducing the head of the son of the head of Cromwell's intelligence service, who had taken flight to the Netherlands and was heterosexual, was a job that was not possible for a man. So it's possible to see how they would have chosen Aphrabane to do that.
And in the time that Aphrabane is around, is active, there's also the court of Charles II, which does present an opportunity for subterfuge with his love of theatre and these two worlds again coming together, presenting opportunities.
Yes, absolutely. But I don't think there's anybody who equals Aphrabane for having begun her career as a spy and then secondly becoming... Well, I think it would be fair to say that nowadays she has a better reputation than any other dramatist from the English Restoration.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But he forged a map, a so-called Nazi map, entirely bogus, with an equally bogus master plan for the Nazi takeover of the whole of South America. And this was passed on to Franklin D. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, not normally a man who's easily fooled.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So there's also this aspect of theatrical censorship. How does this come about, and what impact does this have on the symbiosis between espionage and theatrical?
Well, first of all, it has an enormous impact. Theatrical censorship, there being no film industry, of course, at the time, begins in 1737. And what theatrical censorship, which at the beginning of the 20th century, the beginning of cinemas, is extended to film as well, does, is to prevent the emergence until the First World War and afterwards of the one of the most popular art forms in the modern world and across the whole world, in Britain and in other places. In other words, spy films. You know, easily the most popular film on at this very moment is the latest James Bond film. But spies were pretty much censored out on the stage and in film until the First World War and afterwards. So, you know, this extraordinary popular art form would have emerged much earlier had it not been for censorship.
That's very interesting. So even if that art form wasn't there as a vehicle just yet, there were other forms. There was dance, there's performance. And I wonder if we could talk about a couple of people who were able to harness their performances to enable them to hide in plain sight. One is Mata Hari, which many of our listeners may well know.
Well, Mata Hari is a wonderfully misleading example, because she is, you know, if you ask most people what is the best known male spy in the world, it doesn't matter which part of the world you ask it in, they're going to say James Bond. If you ask them the name of a female spy who's best known, they're going to reply, I think, Mata Hari. Now, Mata Hari, unlike James Bond, was a real person, but she was what can be politely called an exotic dancer, and she specialised in upmarket striptease, I think it's fair to say. So you can see why she captured prurient imaginations. There are two things. Now that her file has been released, and remarkably, her file wasn't released in France until where she was shot as a spy in 1917, until 100 years later, 2017. What does it show? It shows beyond doubt that she was a spy. You know, German communications are intercepted. That proves that. Secondly, it shows beyond imagination that she was a really hopeless spy. What she's done, fictional character as she's become, has done is distract attention from the fact that the most successful French spy of the First World War was a woman. She was also a dancer, a far better dancer. Her name was Mistinguette, and her story did not come out until after her death, because what she had achieved during the First World War, and I've quoted some documents from French archives, was not revealed then. So what happened? She had all kinds of admirers, to use a euphemism, not simply in France, but elsewhere. And at the beginning of the First World War, she goes to the Deuxième Bureau, French military intelligence, and said, I think it would help if I keep in touch with, she didn't say my former lover, but that's what she meant, the Prince Hohenlohe. Now, he was a German prince who was not an important part of the German administration, but he knew people who were. So she kept in touch with him, mainly in Switzerland. And in 1918, as the French archives, not, I think, previously quoted in books in Britain, reveal, Hohenlohe said, you're going to lose. We're going to have a great final offensive in the Champagne area. So it was, from Mistinguett, the best paid French star of the time, that France learned where the final German offensive, which was beaten back, was going to take place. And the same thing happens in the Second World War. The best French spy is once again a woman, Josephine Baker, American origin, but she had taken out French citizenship. And on the last day of November 2021, she is being given the highest honor that any French citizen can be given. Her body is being moved to the Pantheon, which has just over 100 people. And Macron, on that date, makes a great speech explaining what an extraordinary individual she is, but concentrating on her role in the resistance rather than in espionage. So all the fuss about Mata Hari, a tragic figure, has, I think, led people to overlook the two women who really were extraordinary stars, you know, the best paid of their time, and extraordinary spies at the same time. Mata Hari has led people down a lot of dead ends.
Yes, right. I think you're right that there's so much of the popular image of espionage owes to imagination rather than reality. And I feel that's such a good example.
What is curious is that the Mata Hari image continued to influence the Russians rather more than it influenced us. Just about the last thing that the KGB did at the end of the Cold War, before the Soviet system itself collapsed, was to try and make itself more popular by, and there's a picture in the book, announcing that they were appointing a Miss KGB. In other words, the world's most attractive female intelligence officer. And in 2010, when these 10 spies, Russian spies, Putin spies, who had been under surveillance for some time and don't seem to be much good, but nonetheless very good at keeping themselves out of the public eye, were arrested. One of them was called Anna Chapman. And as soon as she went back to Russia, she became a sort of updated Miss KGB.
So something I'd like to pick up on is this idea then of disguise and transformation that is so transferable between these two worlds.
Well, when the Secret Intelligence Service, better known as MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, was founded in 1909, its first head, Mansfield Cumming, drew heavily on the theatre. I mean, we have described how, and he loved dressing up when he went on missions. He used the same theatrical supplier as the main West End theatres. And also, this tends to be left out, there are a lot of wonderful books on Virginia Woolf, but they tend to be considerably more serious than she was. And I can think of university courses on her, which failed to mention that she was one of the great practical jokers of the 20th century. So she went to exactly the same theatrical supplier, and she managed to board the flagship of the Royal Navy, dressed as an Abyssinian prince. And where did she get the beard from? She got the beard from exactly the same theatrical supplier as the head of MI6. And then, of course, during the First World War, some of the station chiefs, as they're called, head of British intelligence in foreign capitals, they include a number of theatricals, including Somerset Maugham. That's difficult now to remember. The Somerset Maugham, before the First World War, was Britain's most successful playwright. Amazingly, At one point, 1909, I think it was, when MI6 was founded, he had four different plays on at four different West End theatres. I think it's probably remained a record since. And then Compton Mackenzie was another one. So when one's looking at the Edwardian Theatre, and when one's looking at the founding of British intelligence, there is a crossover that really hasn't received the attention it deserves.
Well, I'm so glad to have read about it in your book, and I imagine many listeners will enjoy doing so as well. If we can skip a little forward then to some other deception involved in another global conflict, there were people from the entertainment business utilised in events in efforts to bring America into the Second World War. Can we talk a little about Bill Stevenson's office and their use of performers?
Well, this again is an area of Anglo-American relations which tends to be treated too solemnly. So the main aim of British policy in the First World War, foreign policy, was to get the Americans in. And, you know, if we hadn't got the Americans in 1917, goodness knows what would have happened. And at the beginning of the Second World War, and after all, by 1940, when France had got knocked out, Britain stood alone. The main purpose of Churchill's policy was to get the Americans in. And one of the ways that was tried was the main British intelligence organization based in the United States, British Security Coordination, headed by Sir William Stevenson, who called himself later the man called Intrepid. Well, not quite right. He was never called Intrepid. But he got together a series of entertainers who were extremely good at deceiving the Americans. Now, time to just pick one example, but it is an extraordinary example, and I think it's rather difficult to beat in the history of 20th century intelligence. The individual is Eric Mashvitz, who used to be astonishingly well known as Britain's most successful lyricist. These Foolish Things, for example. A nightingale sang in Berkeley Square, for example. But it was he who set up a forgery department for British intelligence in North America. And what did he forge? Well, he forged a number of things. But he forged a map, a so-called Nazi map, entirely bogus, with an equally bogus master plan for the Nazi takeover of the whole of South America. And this was passed on to Franklin D. Roosevelt, the president of the United States, not normally a man who's easily fooled. He was so outraged that less than 2 months before Pearl Harbor, we're talking about October 1941, he gave in an address, a broadcast address to the American people, a denunciation, and he was holding it at the time, this bogus map, and saying he had absolute proof. So what did Eric Mashvitz go on to after the Second World War? He went on to become head of BBC Light Entertainment. And he was so good that he was often offered even more money by independent television, so he went off to that. You know, so a career which begins with these foolish things goes on to fooling on behalf of British intelligence the President of the United States in a way that has never been equal since, and then moves on to run British Light Entertainment. Yes, stars and spies interact there in, I think, a most extraordinary way.
Definitely. It's a remarkable story. And I wonder, why do you think that such remarkable and let's face it, funny episodes to us, why do you think they have fallen out of this history a little and aren't as prevalent as you might think?
Well, mainly because one of the things that really marks the history of British secret intelligence is that it was secret. You know, the CIA was not found, of course, till 1947. But its existence was open from the day that the KGB and its predecessors have held it. But until 1992, the British government, uniquely amongst major governments, refused to admit that it even had a foreign intelligence service. It wasn't till the Queen's speech of 1992 that the government finally admitted what everybody already knew, that there was an MI6. Now, even today, the records of MI6, though book, I hope penetrates them here and there, are totally secret, even the records from before the First World War. So how was the Mashvid secret kept? Well, it was kept very secret at the time, but broadly speaking, because MI6 has been more successful at keeping its secrets than just about any other intelligence service.
Right. And even though you have these layers of secrecy that still exist today, from the 90s, there is also the shift of spies, as you've already alluded to, with the Maxim cover and et cetera, spies becoming stars in their own right and becoming public figures. What's happening there?
Well, it's a continuing process. But what is quite extraordinary is the way that all major Western, and not simply Western intelligence services, have taken to social media. And in the British case, it's just over the last year. It all begins with a tweet by the CIA, a rather comical tweet in 2014. The CIA tweets, "We cannot confirm or deny that this is our first tweet." Well, you know, a year ago, in the autumn of 2020, the new chief of MI6 began to tweet. So, you know, an organization which a generation before had refused to admit it even existed now has regular tweets, and he gives his views on James Bond. He actually preferred Sean Connery to Daniel Craig, and amongst other things, he's held a public quiz on which is the best of John le Carré's novels. In my view, he gets the wrong answer, but he's entitled to disagree with it. And then, of course, he's been also having joint tweets with Stonewall. I mean, my goodness, these things have changed. So, again, if you look at GCHQ on Instagram in particular, our code-breaking organization, now, again, that used to be completely secret. Now it sets little puzzles for you to work out if you would make a codebreaker. And MI5 also has some very jolly tweets. Now, rather Instagram posts. Not all intelligence agencies, now that they recognize the purpose of entertainment, why do they recognize the purpose of entertainment on social media? Well, it's a way of attracting people who might not otherwise think of themselves as recruits. And it's a way of improving their image. But, you know, they don't all get it. I don't want to pick on the CIA in particular, but for example, the CIA sends, every year, it sends Valentine's Day greetings to its followers. Now, this year they were coded. This is the CIA's Valentine's Day message to its followers. And I quote exactly, "Roses are red, violets are blue. Happy Valentine's Day from CIA to you."
That was Christopher Andrew. Stars and Spies, Intelligence Operations and the Entertainment Business. Co-authored with Julius Green, is published by The Bodley Head and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.